Almost 2 years ago, reporter Andrew Revkin, who writes the Dot Earth blog for the New York Times, was running with his son when he suddenly couldn't catch his breath. It turns out that he was experiencing the beginnings of a stroke. He's written about what happened over the next 12 months in an article called My Stroke of Luck on the front page of today's Science Times section of the New York Times. And it is my pleasure to welcome Andy Revkin back to our show today. Hello.
It's great to be with you.
The Center
Literally.
You've been here in the interim, and
yeah.
I had no idea.
Well, I was, as I said, very lucky in more ways than I had thought. You know, some of the luck is just, you know, how bad a clot is it? What vessels are occluded? The plasticity of your brain. So there was that stuff. And then there was this instance I talk about in the piece where I thought I was really smart at one point where I took some baby aspirin when I was kind of thinking, is this a stroke? After I had these symptoms after running. And I took baby aspirin just because, you know, I, like many people, I kind of know that it's an anticoagulant, but aspirin, and thought that was pretty wise. And then later on, it seemed clear that it was wise. But then, you know, something like 10% of strokes are from bleeding, not from clotting. And so if I had taken the aspirin and I'd had the other kind of stroke, I would have killed myself. So that was very lucky.
Another stroke of luck.
In a different way, yeah.
The Center for Disease Control estimates that strokes kill over 130,000 people in the United States each year. How many of those fatalities could have been prevented if people were more aware of risk factors and the signs of a stroke?
Well, that's just part of the cost. The other thing is it's the leading cause of disability. You know, anyone who's been around knows a family who's had a stroke victim. It's an enduring loss of capacity, enduring headaches and costs, which can add up to monumental costs. You know, how much could be avoided? It's always hard to prove that kind of thing, but a lot. Let's put it that many billions of dollars worth of money could be saved by more prompt treatment. And some of that's about people recognizing symptoms quickly. People have trouble smiling symmetrically when they have a stroke, can't hold your hands up in front of you. So if someone's talking weird, a marine biologist I know, Ellen Pickich, after she read my blog about the stroke, which was earlier on, she realized she was having a stroke last year. And for her, her symptoms, she said, was word salad. The words coming out of her mouth were not the words she was forming in her brain. And her husband thought, this is pretty weird. They happened to be near a good hospital and went right in and ended up in the stroke unit. So, and time, you know, as I say in the article, time is brain. That's the mantra of stroke care people. And it really means time wasted is brain lost.
And you suffered what some neurologists call a brain attack. What were the first symptoms you noticed?
Well, for me, it started, again, I was running on a hot day up a hill, really strenuous thing I hadn't really been doing a lot of. And my left eye started telling me the world was kind of like paisley. It was as if I was looking through a curtain. And another woman I know who had a similar stroke, for her impression was the world was like chrysanthemums. That's the thing, the memory she had. So it's kind of a fragmented vision, one eye, and I hadn't yet had the stroke. This was an occlusion of the vessel by something called a carotid dissection. The lining of your carotid artery sometimes can give way and just sort of literally block the flow in the artery, but it's not like a clotting may not have happened yet even. And that's what had happened. That's why my eyesight went sour. And that's what prompted me to take some baby aspirin and eventually get to the emergency room and then have this kind of slow motion triage.
Well, once you got to the hospital, your vital signs were normal.
Yeah.
And the hospital was ready to release you despite the fact that your pupils were different sizes.
Yeah, that's a condition called Horner's syndrome. You know, I learned all this. I blogged from the hospital while I was the day after when I'd actually suffered the stroke. Luckily, I wasn't completely incapacitated. I could type in a kind of Hunt and Peck way. And I learned about Horner's syndrome, which is kind of a classic signal that you have one of these blocked artery situations, and that can lead to stroke. The stroke is actually loss of brain, you know, brain function. So I learned a lot in a hurry, and then since then I've been kind of learning more, and that's what prompted this follow-up article in the Times.
Was there a stroke specialist there on that holiday weekend?
It was 4th of July weekend. There was a neurologist, but not a stroke specialist. And this is where one of the main themes of my story is about the technology that is available. It's basically like Skype on steroids. that allows you could have the world's best stroke neurologist, or certainly the best one in New York State, in any hospital emergency room with the right kind of gear. And as I mentioned a minute ago, most of the symptoms, signs of stroke, initial ones, are visual. The person's gait, their smile, their demeanor, and so you can, what can happen quickly as a result of this kind of connection is treatment with the right clot busting drug at the right time can really save lives and again an enormous amount of disability.
Can it prevent the actual stroke? Because at this point you still haven't had the stroke.
Yeah, well, that's what, in my situation, it was really weird. I was in the hospital. Then they transferred me to Westchester County Medical Center, a bigger one, and that's where I started receiving a real anticoagulant treatment, heparin. But sometime that night, overnight, I woke up the next morning having had, I couldn't move most of the fingers on my right hand. Yeah, I couldn't really move, couldn't get out of bed, had a lot of pain behind my eye, and that's when I was, and then the MRI said there was a big, if you go on the Times website, you can see my brain and the lost cells. They're like a little, looks like the Milky Way. And it's kind of sobering to, you know, to realize what had happened. Although, again, in my case, again, very lucky situation overall.
But you say earlier, it seemed to you that the hospital staff ramped down their concern about your case.
Oh, they did, yeah.
Just when they should have been swinging to high gear. Isn't there fairly universal agreement in the medical community about the warning signs of a major stroke?
Yeah, although in an emergency room with a youngish person, at the time I was 55, I'm now 57, so, you know, they're not necessarily looking for stroke. I had been running, I was overheated, I didn't have any, in the initial, they did a CAT scan there and didn't see anything.
And you asked them for an ultrasound of your carotid arteries. What made you think of doing that?
Well, this is just one of these random things where my GP had told me literally a few months earlier, just as a general kind of proactive monitoring thing, he said, you know, let's get your carotid arteries ultrasound of your carotids just to be sure they're nice and fine and healthy and not occluded, you know, with plaque. I didn't do it. Months had gone by. And so when I had the situation, one of the things in my head was, hey, maybe I should have gotten that carotid artery scan. And so I suggested it, and I mentioned, call my ophthalmologist. My GP was out. And they did, and they did the scan. That was the most vivid moment of this whole thing for me, was being in an emergency room, in triage, having an ultrasound technician with the little probe with the gel on it kind of scanning my neck, and then she called somebody else over, and they couldn't find my carotid artery. And it was then I heard the words, there's no flow in your left carotid artery. I thought, that's how could I be awake, you know, conscious, alive, talking to you, and have that be the case? And it was at that point that they decided it was time to transfer me to another hospital.
But if you hadn't made the suggestion...
I know. Who knows?
How important is being your own advocate in a hospital?
Well, you know, it's a very fine line. I think you really do need to be your own advocate as much as possible. But as I said with the aspirin, you know, sometimes your instincts are not right. If I had... And there are... It is a complicated diagnosis. This Horner syndrome carotid dissection thing, it's not like I shouldn't use the word no-brainer. It's not just sort of a clear-cut alarm bell. To their credit, you know, I don't think it was calamitously wrong. Although what it was, I think, is this sort of defensive form of medicine. It was a quiet weekend. Emergency rooms are always overtaxed. And I didn't have any actual signs of stroke itself, meaning my brain was intact. So they were doing sort of a defensive, this guy's okay, let him go kind of diagnosis instead of a what could this be signaling diagnosis. That's my impression.
My guest is Andrew Revkin, whose article, My Stroke of Luck, is on the front page of today's Science Times section of the New York Times. You can also find it, a link to it, on our show page at WNYC.org. Back in 2011, you tweeted, quote, don't stress your carotid arteries if you like your brain and the things it does for you. What part of the brain does the carotid artery get blood to?
Well, you know, it's kind of, there is a little bit of a roulette aspect to this. So once you have clotting and the clots flow into your brain, they go through the, I can't remember, there's a big artery that initially branches off from the carotid. And, you know, it's sort of like one of those avalanche games where it could go anywhere. In fact, the woman I spoke about earlier who had the word salad symptoms, clearly her brain problem was in another part of her brain, for mine. For me, it went to the corona radiata, which is a sort of a connective part of the brain, connecting sort of this processing part to a signal part. And it led to, you know, as I said, my right hand, and this is a real bummer because I spend my life typing and sometimes playing guitar, was not working, and other things were impeded. But it was, there's sort of a luck of the draw aspect of it.
And you note that this kind of injury, the kind you suffered, can result from things that we don't normally associate with this sort of thing, certain yoga moves, painting the ceiling, or tipping your head back when you're getting a shampoo at a salon. So how common are those kinds of strokes?
Well, they're still rare. Most strokes are not from that cause. There's, as we said, something like 700,000 strokes in America a year, and the vast majority are from clotting or some occlusion related to other kinds of things. More chronic stuff. You know, there are people that I walk by on the street who might be sweaty and red-faced and stressed out, and you think, man, there's a guy who's just a stroke in waiting. That I shouldn't have been thinking that all this time, because it can happen to people who are relatively healthy, relatively young. The demographic for stroke is shifting a little bit. There's more. There was just a paper that I linked to in the article about about 20% of strokes are in younger people, meaning sort of 50s down, and that seems to be a rising thing.
Do we know why? Could it be related to stress levels, as you suggested earlier?
Well, from what I saw in the literature, it was kind of a mixed bag. I don't think they really know yet. But again, these things, like when you stress your neck in certain ways, that is what can lead to what's called this carotid dissection. The lining of the artery gets stressed and gives way, literally like the lining of a hose blocking the hose. And they have established that it can happen at the beauty parlor, that nice head-tipping shampoo, chiropractic visits. There seems to be a relationship or some link, but it's hard still to show. When I did my kind of post-stroke assessment visit to my general practitioner a month or so later, he said he's had 4 patients in his career, about 20 years, who had a carotid dissection leading to stroke, and the other 3 were from chiropractic visits. Although that's anecdotal. You know, again, from what I saw in the literature, it's still kind of a maybe.
The doctors are still at war with chiropractors, so
there you
go. Shouldn't be surprised. Your doctor's mantra to you was, time is brain? What does that mean?
Time wasted is brain lost. Ah. And that's why I'm such a big fan of what's called telemedicine. The piece has an interview. I have a video interview on .earth, my blog at the Times, with a guy who invented this system that essentially allows a stroke specialist to be, who might be in Phoenix or New York City, to be in an emergency room in Garrison or on an Indian reservation in Arizona, which actually happens in Arizona now. They have a good telestroke system there. And evaluating in real time a patient and helping the doctors in the emergency room make a decision about swift diagnosis. They now have it so that a doctor, a neurologist, can be in the ambulance via iPad.
But Medicare and other insurers don't reimburse for this,
even though
it seems like the future of medicine is heading in that direction.
Well, old norms die hard, and part of it is licensing. A doctor in Arizona can't diagnose a patient in New Mexico. There are several sections of the country that are designated as rural, where they do reimburse if the doctor is not at your bedside. But in my case, as I wrote in my piece, look, there was no doctor at my bedside to bill. There was no specialist there to bill because it was 4th of July weekend. So I would happily have a virtual neurologist there, and that was not possible because the hospital didn't have this set up.
Well, it wasn't until late that night that the blood clot that had been forming separated and you technically had the stroke.
Yeah.
Did you feel the effects of it right away?
Well, when I woke up in the morning, I did sleep through the night, and I just realized, oh my gosh, something bad's happened. And it was when I saw the MRI, the image of my brain, that particular slice of my brain where there was dead cells. And I thought, oh my, this is a pretty stunning thing to consider.
And how has it affected the way you've lived your life since?
Well, I think, I don't know about other people, but I ended up very conflicted because when you have as I say in the piece, when you have a run-in with the Reaper it can make you, inspire you to slow down and sit with your kids and relish every day. But at the same time, part of you is saying, wow, life is so short. Get everything done now. And, you know, I have a lot to do. I've got books to write, and I'm recording an album of my songs, and I need to, you know, communicate. I'm kind of a compulsive communicator, and so my blogging is relentless. And so for me, the get it all done part seemed to dominate the relish every day part, and I'm still working that out.
And don't we have to get things done a little quicker? You write for the Dot Earth blog for the New York Times when you're not writing about your health. Earlier this week, we heard that we had crossed the 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. A threshold scientists were really concerned about. Should we all be worried?
Well, you know, it's kind of like monitoring your own health. We all get signals and warnings from our doctors. You know, what I heard about my carotid arteries ultrasound. In this case, I don't think it mattered, but you know, we tend to discount these looming, slow drip kind of signals we get from the risk. The people telling us about risk, whether it's a climatologist or your physician, and there comes a point when you go, oh, that's interesting. And for me, in terms of my health, you know, I realized this was one of those points. And again, in my case, it wasn't like I was a stroke in waiting. I have slightly elevated blood pressure, but I'm basically a healthy person, so I can't say it's just like global warming in that sense. But I did write my blog post that day from the hospital. Was you have to start with sustaining yourself if your goal is to sustain the planet. You really do. It all does. You can't really get anything done if you're not functioning and healthy. So it's sort of step one.
Andrew Revkin writes the Dot Earth blog for the New York Times. His article in today's Science Times section of the New York Times is called My Stroke of Luck. It's on the front page. And you can also find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Andy, thank you so much for talking with us again.
It's great to be with you, and I look forward to the next time.